Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. For generations, Americans have taken it as a given that buying a home is both a solid financial investment and a critical part of fulfilling their American dream. But we know that many of you out there in your 20s, 30s, and 40s are having a quiet conversation and asking, is that still the case for our generation? And we know it's a terrifying question. Thankfully, Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, dare to ask that question out loud this week. Is this generation of potential homeowners the first generation for which buying a home isn't a no-brainer? She wrote up some interesting data in her column this week and joins us now. Hi, Catherine. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here.
You start out your column by citing two studies that show that Americans, even 5 years into the housing-fueled Great Recession, still think of buying a home as the most sound long-term financial investment. It comes out ahead of mutual funds and bonds and so on. Does the data refute that assumption?
I don't know that I would outright say it refutes that assumption, but it certainly questions it. If you look at the long-term gains, the long-term returns to homeownership over the last several decades, over the last century, not even just, you know, in the year since the housing bust, when obviously it was a very risky asset. In the years when it seemed very safe, the annual gains to housing are a little bit less than 1%, which is not a great return. And that number is also not taking into account the costs of homeownership, things like property taxes and maintenance and various other expenses, homeowners insurance. So, you know, a home is a good place to live. I think it brings a lot of people a lot of joy for many reasons and a sense of security. But it's not as if it's going to make you rich, at least if you look at the historical numbers.
It's certainly counterintuitive when you look at the data and think of the way we tend to experience these things. You write that, quote, over the past century, housing prices have grown at a compound annual rate of just over 0.3%. Once one adjusts for inflation. Over the same period, the S&P 500 stock index has a comparable annual return of about 6.5%. So that's way less than 1% to more than 6.5% to more than 6% stocks versus owning a home. And yet Americans still think it's financially savvy and more financially safe. Do you think that's because of the particular experience of one generation, the post-World War II generation, which, you know, bought homes all over, certainly all over the metro area for $30,000, $60,000 in the 1950s and 60s, and now they're worth hundreds of thousands or a million?
I think it's partly that. Your memory kind of plays tricks on you, I think. I actually spoke with the Nobel laureate Robert Shiller at Yale, who's done a lot of work on housing. You know, he won a Nobel for his work on asset prices and things like that, but he kind of became a household name in the last decade or so because he called the housing bubble pretty early. And I talked with him about this. I said, so why is it that, you know, despite the data, people seem so attached to this idea that housing is a really good investment? And he said one of the explanations that he gave anyway was that people remember very vividly the amount of money that they paid for their home, as you mentioned. You know, you can ask them, how much did you pay for your home? And it could have been 50 years ago. And it was such a large, emotional, significant purchase that that number sticks with them. And it might be something, you know, like $30,000. So they remember that. They look at what house prices have done today and they say, geez, house prices have gone up so much, not really thinking about the fact that prices overall have risen tremendously during that time. You know, they're not sort of doing the mental calculation for inflation. And because that price sticks out, you know, that their home price sticks out in their mind, they're making this comparison that's a little bit unfair in a way that they may not remember, you know, what the S&P 500 looked like 50 years ago. They may not remember what was in their savings account 50 years ago. But because that price, that home price number is so salient that that kind of sticks out in their mind and gives them this very vivid image of, wow, you know, this investment has really turned out well.
So listeners, if you're in this boat right now, call in with the questions that you're asking yourself. Are you thinking about buying a home? Maybe you're a young single or in a young couple, about to have kids, you recently had kids. You're deciding, should I buy a home or should I just keep on renting? Should I even consider renting as a permanent condition for my life because that's actually financially advantageous? 212-433-WNYC. Do you think you're having this conversation in a different way than your parents might have? 212-433-9692. Or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Or if you recently bought a home, let's say if you bought a home in the last 10 years, just before, just after the financial crisis, do you regret it? 212-433-9692 for Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. Of course, Catherine, this comparison that we're making between buying a home and the S&P 500, the alternative to owning stocks is not owning stocks, but the alternative to owning a house or a home is renting. So you're making a monthly financial commitment either way. And
right.
The conventional wisdom is either you're putting it into equity that you'll eventually get back someday or can borrow on or whatever, or you're, you know, flushing it down the toilet into the pocket of your landlord.
Right. And this is a very important point. I think what people don't realize is that monthly mortgage payments are still generally much higher than monthly rent payments. When you're paying for your mortgage, when you're paying to buy your home, you're sort of paying two separate things that are bundled together. One is the right to live there. That's effectively the rent. You know, how much would it cost to live in an equivalent home, equivalent size and quality home, if you weren't, you know, if you weren't trying to get your name on the deed, basically, if you were just renting it. And then the other is basically the right to take a bet on whether the home's value is going to increase at the end of the 30-year mortgage or however long the mortgage is. So yes, you are paying – when you pay your mortgage payment, you are getting the benefit of living there. But in an alternative scenario, you could say, okay – let's say I try to rent a place that is equally sized, equally nice, and I use that difference between what I would have paid in my mortgage bill every month and the slightly lower rent that I'm paying for the rental home, and I invested that in the stock market or some other asset that's much more diversified. What happens then? And, you know, generally speaking, you still come out ahead. It really depends on what market you're in. You know, if you had bought on the west side of Manhattan in the early 80s rather than rented, you'd be doing very well today. You know, once upon a time, that neighborhood didn't look so nice, and now it's quite expensive. You could say the same thing for the Mission District in San Francisco. But not necessarily for, you know, Detroit or Cleveland or a lot of places where home values have not kept up. And it's very hard to tell ex ante where that good investment is going to be. If you look at the overall average numbers, you know, what the median home price was in the country in, you know, 1982, and the median what's called imputed rent for that home, that's mm-hmm. like, a, you know, the equivalent of how much it would cost to rent that place. And you said, okay, if I bought it outright versus if I rented it and then invested, you know, the $70,000, which is about what the median home cost back then, if I had invested that in the S&P 500, where would I come out? And, you know, again, on just this sort of median home, you'd come out better if you had invested it elsewhere.
And paid your rent.
And paid your rent.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 NetCong and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we talk about the new calculation between renting and owning. And Adam in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Adam.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I just wanted to say, you know, I am recently married, and my wife and I have been looking for a home for about the past year. I still really believe that it's important for middle-class Americans to own a home. If people like my wife and myself don't own these homes, somebody will. And, you know, rather than just pay rent, which I do feel like I'm throwing the money away every month, and we're currently paying $1,600 a month for a one-bedroom apartment, you know, we figured out to get a home, our mortgage is going to be somewhere around $2,000 to $2,400 a month for something that works for us. But again, there is a value there, and I still feel that it's the cornerstone of a middle-class lifestyle in this country, and it's a marker that I still think people are judged by.
So there's something for you beyond the financial calculation. There's a question of status. You said something people are going to be judged by, and something beyond that that relates to a notion of being a grown-up, in a way, in America. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, absolutely. And the other thing here is, again, are we going to become a society of, and it gets to class disparity to a certain degree, where, you know, again, these properties are going to be owned one way or another. And the question is, are they going to be owned by the people who are occupying them, which are going to allow those people to build equity and, you know, hopefully someday fund for retirement? Or are they going to be owned by investors who are already mm-hmm. rich and who are already profiting? And are we just going to
right.
keep, you know, lining their pockets?
Do we want to live in landlord nation? But did you
exactly.
do the kind of number crunching for yourself that Catherine was just going through for the hypothetical family that would or would not have bought in the average American city in the 1980s? Did you look down the road and say, okay, I'm going to be sinking X into this home that I'm looking to buy in mortgage payments and in maintenance, as compared to if I was renting the equivalent space and keeping that extra, because it's cheaper to rent than to buy, keeping that extra and putting it in the stock market for the next 30 years of my life? I mean, have you crunched it like that for yourself?
We did, and we looked at it actually in two different ways. Part of the issue, at least in Westchester, is inventory. I don't want to raise, you know, again, we're a newly married couple. I don't want to raise my family in an apartment building. I want them to have a yard to play in.
You could rent a house. There are plenty of houses for rent, right?
There's not. And that's my second point. And again, the prices, the houses that are for rent in Westchester, the prices are equivalent to a mortgage,
uh-huh.
essentially. You know, you're looking for a two-bedroom to a three-bedroom house in Westchester, anywhere from $2,000 to $3,000 a month, which falls in line, basically, with
the mortgage payments. Adam, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much. And Catherine, he raises a very important point here, a couple. One is, do we want to live in landlord nation, where if you're advising every average person to be a renter rather than an owner, then we're all going to be subservient, if that's the right word, or, you know, indentured to in some way this landlord class that we would be empowering. And
but you might be richer.
But you might
You might be richer, so I don't know how that makes you indebted to them.
Right.
You know, I think there are a few different things that came up in that conversation. You know, one is the sort of emotional and tangible social benefits of home ownership. You know, the idea that it's a key to the American dream, to being a member of the middle class, to being seen as a grown-up, in your words. And I think that those are all completely legitimate and important reasons to own a home.
And what about – go yes. ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the issue is, you know, that people derive a lot of these, let's call them psychic benefits as opposed to financial benefits from
uh-huh.
home ownership.
Right.
But they also overstate the financial benefits. And as a result, they're probably buying more house than actually makes them happy. You know, I hear this from a lot of people who are new homeowners in the last few years when I've been covering economics, that people say, I want to own, you know, I like the idea of having my own property. I thought I would get a two-bedroom or whatever, but look, I qualified for a five-bedroom. I might as well get that. And I think that there's this idea that because the financial benefits are supposedly so great, and besides, you know, there are tax incentives that sort of push you in this direction too, that I should sort of consume as much housing as I can, with people not remembering that this is one asset. You're sinking a lot of money into that one asset, which bears risk. You know, you're not diversifying. And you're tying up all of your savings or much of your savings there, and you're leaving these sort of opportunity costs on mm-hmm. the table, that maybe you can still get the benefit of homeownership, but at a home that actually fits your needs and makes you happy without buying all the extra, you know, the extra bedrooms and the extra land, and you could use the money you would have spent on that to invest on in something else.
What about the distinction that he made between people who want to live in an apartment and people who want to live in a house? I have a friend who's selling a really nice house in a really nice part of Westchester, and she can't believe that it's only like $600,000, which, you know, is not that much compared to what she paid for it decades ago, compared to the little apartment that, you know, people are selling in New York City for $1 million, and saying, so if he's looking to compare mortgage to rental in the suburbs, they're actually much closer than they would be in the city. Plus, there aren't houses for rent the way there are apartments for rent.
So I have two thoughts on that. One is that just comparing the mortgage to the rental price is still not sufficient. I mean, I think in most functional markets, you'll see that the rental prices should be a little bit lower because, again, you're paying just for the right to live there, as opposed to with a mortgage, you're paying for the right to live there plus the right to own it plus the interest. But even that, even if they are equivalent, you know, you're still not taking into account property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You're not taking into account maintenance. You know, if you want to keep up the value of the
mm-hmm.
home,
right.
You know, not just for yourself because you have to live there, but
right.
because you think you might want to resell it at some point, that costs a lot of money. You know, the rule of thumb that I've heard is anywhere between 1% and 4% of the value of the home that you have to spend in maintenance, although obviously it varies greatly. So there are a lot of other costs.
And there aren't a lot of nice houses for rent, at least not today.
Yes.
Until your vision of a new American housing market comes to pass, there just aren't a lot of nice houses for rent for families who want to live in a nice house, right?
I mean, yeah, so that's part of the issue. It's that because this country has been so oriented towards home ownership as opposed to rentals, you know, you sort of have this self-fulfilling prophecy that you don't have a lot of nicer home rentals on the market, you know, that are equivalent to the places you can buy. That's not true in all markets, especially in a lot of areas that were hit pretty badly by the housing bust, in places like Las Vegas and in Phoenix and parts of California. You know, a lot of investors have bought up homes and turned them into rentals.
Right.
So you could have, you know, a housing development where every house looks the same, but some of them are for rent and some of them are to buy. But again, that's sort of an unintended consequence of the fact that we tried to make home ownership so easy for everyone that now you have this result where you have a lot of nicer housing that was built up initially as places to own that then people realized they could not afford to own that are now falling into the rental category.
Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell reassessing the calculation between renting and owning a home in America. And Michael, who moved from New York to Mobile, Alabama. Is that right, Michael?
That's right. I left about 7 years ago, but as I was telling you, screener, once you've heard Brian Lehrer and WNYC, you get addicted.
All right.
To the internet.
I'm glad you're still listening. And you're starting to sound like a Southerner, Michael. I hear that little lilt.
Actually, I grew up in the South, moved to New York, and then came back basically to try and help out with Katrina recovery in New Orleans and just stayed down here. Anyway, obviously, I'm not talking about the New York market. But I think maybe part of the problem of what led to the housing crisis is to look at housing as, quote unquote, an investment. How much money am I going to get out of this for me? Owning a house is about a sense of security, a sense of stability, a sense of privacy. I'm an amateur musician. You know, I'd like to be able to have enough space to invite some musicians over and practice without people banging on walls.
They say that's what Williamsburg is for. No, I'm just kidding. Michael, thank you very much. And Ken on Twitter isn't buying this argument. He writes us, rent goes up with inflation while mortgage payments go down, plus interest is deductible. So there's the tax equation, too. Have you taken all of that into account, Catherine?
I can't speak for every single person's financial decision here. Rent goes up, yes, but, you know, mortgage payments are pretty substantial. And like I said, property taxes go up, too, as do maintenance costs. You have an older home. It's going to cost more to maintain it over time. So, you know, you buy a new house in 1980s, let's say, and maybe your maintenance costs are minimal. But over time, there's all that upkeep. The place has gotten more use. And those kind of costs rise, too. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that go into this calculation. And my point is just that we need to be skeptical of this idea that you buy a home and it is absolutely the way to get rich. If not to get rich, it's the best way, at least the safest investment for your money that brings a decent return. And if you look at alternate ways you could be investing at least some of the money that gets tied up in your house, if you're spending all of your money on your house, you might be better off.
Matt.
So, yes.
So Matt in Queens, you're on WNYC. Matt, what's your story?
Good morning, Brian.
Hi, Matt.
Hi. Okay, so my story is that my wife and I call her my wife, we're getting married next week. We live in Elmhurst, and we pay pretty reasonable rent for New York City. We have a very good living arrangement in our one-bedroom apartment. But we're worried that we're going to get priced out of our neighborhood, and that's really the only reason why we've even been talking about buying. We have no interest in homeownership. We're just worried about, being priced out. We're deeply skeptical about costs and taxes and everything else that comes with it. And not to mention the idea that if there's some sort of a terrorist attack, and our apartment is irradiated, where would we then go? So for people who think that can't happen, 9/11 happened. So all of these things are going through my head, and I think this is one of the best topics we could possibly have on the show ever.
Well, if you like this topic, I refer you to our coming special on May 6th, which is going to be 2 hours on renting. We're going to do a special on rent coming up on Tuesday, May 6th program. But, Matt, thank you for your experience. And so there's a particularly New York experience, right, and a particularly New York set of fears, Catherine, and maybe Washington, too, where you live. But on the one hand, I'm going to own this thing, and then if, you know, the dirty bomb hits, it's going to be irradiated, and I'm going to be stuck with it. On the other hand, how not to get gentrified out of the neighborhood that he's been living in is to buy there now while he can afford the asking price rather than sit with the inflating rents and lose it in a few years.
I would say actually that some of those concerns are not specific to New York. I mean, New Yorkers may be more concerned about terrorist attacks, but there are lots of other, you know, unforeseen acts of God that could happen that could wipe your home off the map that are caused by nature, for example. You know, you could this is true in New York. You know, we had Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
When was that? Last year? 2 years ago, I guess, at this point. Right? Yes, 2 years ago at this point, almost.
Getting there.
A lot of people lost their homes then. You know, this happens in other parts of the country, too, because of hurricanes, because of floods, because of whatever, because of fires. You know, when you own the home, you bear the risk, whether it's something that's a major storm or, you know, your roof collapses or whatever. So you are taking on these additional risks because you own the place. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if you're renting, your landlord is at least supposed to make sure that you have hot water and that sort of thing.
Let me get one more story on the table here, because it really is going to place it, I think, in our metro area in a different way. Kurt in Rivervale, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I just want to say I'm a huge fan of your show, Brian. I love it.
Thank you.
My question is, I'm in process of moving out of a house that I've lived in all my life in Rivervale. The property taxes is close to $12,000 a year, and I simply can't afford living there by myself anymore. I'm purchasing or have purchased a condominium, and for the cost of property taxes, I'm now going to be putting that money into a mortgage and getting equity back rather than just having that money go to all kinds of services and things like that. So where your focus has been mostly about being a homeowner versus renting an apartment, I'm just curious how you would compare being a homeowner to a condo owner, where a lot of those problems and things like that I really don't have to worry about
right.
anymore.
It's such a great question. And again, it's such a New York question or any metro area kind of question. Does the calculation change? You know, some people say, oh, you're going to spend all that money on a co-op or a condo, and then you're going to have the maintenance on top of it, which is akin to rent on top of the mortgage. On the other hand, if the pipes burst, he calls the landlord. He doesn't have to figure out how to be a plumber or pay a plumber. And it's a different kind of lifestyle, too.
I think that actually that's the move that a lot more people should be making across the country, that when the home that they've owned forever, even if they've paid down the mortgage, becomes somewhat of a nuisance for them, you know, to maintain, to pay for, that they should be downsizing, whether that means that they're downsizing to a rental place or to a place that they're buying. I think really depends on how much value they place on the benefits of either, whether it's, you know, like we were talking about, some sense of security and ownership that is very valuable to people, versus the flexibility of being a renter and being able to move. I think a lot of that comes down to sort of personal preferences as opposed to mm-hmm. the financial benefits. But the fact that that Americans are thinking about these types of things and thinking about downsizing, I think, is important, precisely because a lot of them are not getting the full value of the home that they are having to pay for.
In the post-McMansion era, Catherine Rampell, opinion columnist for The Washington Post, discussing her piece this week, reassessing the choice that young Americans this generation are being faced with between renting and owning. We've linked to her piece at WNYC.org. And Catherine, you've started a fascinating discussion here. I'll just wrap it up by reading a tweet from Nikki with another wrinkle, that the link between property taxes and schools, writes Nikki, means renters may not be invested in their neighborhood as much. So some of those structural elements would have to change to see Catherine Rampell's vision come true, writes Nikki, and something to follow up on in 2 weeks. And yes, folks, the lines are full. We could keep going with this. The comments page is hopping. People are tweeting and Facebooking us. So keep going on all of that among each other. And consider this kind of a teaser, because the week after next, Tuesday, May 6th, we'll do a full two-hour special, a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on renting. Catherine, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When it gets down to the cities, then the water turns into a dirty gray. It's poisoned and polluted by the people as it flows along its way.
Johnny Cash. Singing Don't Go Near the Water.
Don't go near the water. Water isn't water anymore.
An old-fashioned environment Earth Day song before global warming became the everything of talking about the environment, almost, or so it seems. 212-433-WNYC for immigrants from anywhere. This latest section of our Earth Day Earth Day family meeting here on the Brian Lehrer Show. Immigrants from anywhere. Talk about how the global warming conversation takes place in the country that you came from compared to the United States now that you're here. And here, for example, is Mohamed Nasheed, former president of the Maldives, speaking on our show in June 2012.
Climate change is a very real issue in the Maldives. It's not something in the future. It is happening now. We have 16 islands that need relocation because of coastal erosion. We have 70 islands that have contaminated water because of seawater intrusion into our water lens, and we are having to desalinate water. We have dwindling fish catch because the fish is not rising because of, I'm told, temperature differences in the ocean. So this is not something that is going to happen. This is happening right now. And it is happening in many, many coastal countries and in many coastal areas.
The former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, on the show in June of 2012, saying, hey, people, our country is literally going to drown unless your country does something. How about your country of origin? 212-433-9692. Anu in Plainville, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Anu. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day, Brian. Enjoy your show every single morning. I come from India. I'm North Indian, and the city I often visit when I go back home is New Delhi, which is known for its pollution. The amount of crud you get on your face within an hour when you land, you can wipe it out and you could see. So the mayor of New Delhi built a fantastic subway system. The metro stations are clean. Everything is air conditioned. The trains are cleaner, believe it or not, than our New York City subways are. But because of the class attitude, the learned don't have, A, as much conversation as we do here, and B, refuse to get on the subway because they associate that with the form of transportation that the working class needs to take rather than the rich and the people who found money recently. So they get surprised when I say, I'm taking the subway and I'll reach to the other part of the city way before you will in your air-conditioned car.
So,
and it's very amazing to see the look on their face. Why would you take the metro?
So are you saying that how tangible it is for some people in the new middle or wealthier classes in India to be emerging from poverty make it more difficult for them to look at the impact on global warming of the new lifestyles that they're embracing?
Yes, for the new and the emerging and also the established, because I run into a lot of people with old money and the attitudes of money and wealth and how important it is to sit in your air-conditioned car rather than rubbing shoulders with somebody who may have been a cashier at the store you were just shopping in. It's just amazing how much class dictates actions and thoughts and discussions there.
You know, one of the earlier guests on our show said there is no way that the world should have the conversation that India and China, for example, should not have the right to develop their standard of living to the same degree that the United States has. It will never be acceptable. So the only approach is to find those technologies that will kind of solve the global warming problem for everybody equally by implementing them across the board, because judging or asking people from India or China not to consume more when for the first time they can consume more is just too unacceptable. What would you say to that?
I don't know. I don't think there is as much in-depth thought process, at least in the people that I run into.
Mm-hmm.
And these are well-educated people who some of them were expats here and they studied and they went back after getting their American stamp. And even there, the conversation is not about uniformity. I don't think they think about uniformity, the wellness of the nation as a whole. I think there is a very individualized or a smaller organizational way of thinking.
Yes.
How can I get ahead?
Right.
And it's not just the new money, Brian. There are a lot of people sitting with old money, royalty,
yes,
that has converted, you know, themselves into businesses and what have you.
And I hear your
and
point.
And even there, the conversation is never at a global level or even a national level.
Mm. Anu, thank you very much. And I hear that point that you keep coming back to about old money. And Anderson in Brazil, in Midtown, originally from Brazil, right, Anderson?
Yes, yes. In Brazil, there's a lot of conversation, like here, about global warming, what can we do, what should be done. But usually what comes down to is blaming the United States for the problems of anything related to global warming. But, you know, but I think when I go there, I talk to friends and family, and I say, you know, but look around. Are we doing anything here actually to help? We are not, because Brazil, São Paulo, for example, is a very large city. Everything's paved, people's backyard, the streets, and there's almost no patch of grass anywhere. Water, that leads to flood. There's garbage thrown everywhere in certain areas. That leads to clogged sewers, major flooding, property damage. And São Paulo itself has a weather, a temperature that's much higher in the region. You know, it's really hot. Summer is unbearable. Little things like that that have major effects, people forgetting. But everybody loves to talk about global warming, but when it comes down to each one doing their part, people forget that. They don't really do it. Lights are on, left on all night in major buildings. Trucks and buses using old engines that burn a lot of fuel, contributing to pollution, to health. This is the kind of thing that I really bothers me. They usually want to blame the United States.
Too easy to blame the United States and then just leave it at that. Anderson, I hear you. Thank you very much. Peter in Hillside, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Thank you. Yes, my own 2 cents, I have to make an input, is I'm from Nigeria, and I'm from the eastern part of Nigeria. Mm-hmm. I'm from Imo State. The environmental concern is more of a natural thing. We are not highly activist, or there's no legislation in, like, the government telling you what to do or whatever. It's more of a natural thing. Like when the elders will tell you, you can't waste water, you can't put garbage in here, you can't do this. So they perpetuate that environmental concern. I think it might be an agricultural thing. So you don't have like a legislation say if you do this, you get fined or you get a ticket for doing it. It's more of a natural thing. You tell the kids you can't do this, you can't kill a bird, you can't throw garbage in here. In fact, I'm from Owerri, the capital. They have a society called Keep Owerri Beautiful Society. So when you have a garbage, you don't just throw it anywhere. You have to hold it in your hand till you see a garbage can. And when I was little, even when I came to States, I would always hold garbage in my hand. I don't just throw it out just like that. It's something I can't even get to do till today. A lot of times when I was when I came new here, I was working at McDonald's. I see customers, when you give them their drink, they just take the straw off and they throw the straw, the garbage right there on drive-thru. And I was like, wow. Those things is something you have to be conscious of. You start from homes. When you teach kids, like, you can't do this, you can't do that, they carry them with them. You don't have to legislate or have environmental activists to tell you, you got to do this.
You're not saying it's that people in America are bigger slobs than people in Nigeria, but rather that it's a family-to-family thing?
Right. It's more of a cultural thing. You hand it from one person to another. You have to do this. That's one area I think Nigeria has done well in the environment. Even though we are highly tropical, but there's so much emphasis on planting trees, on having a garden in your yard, in your house. Make your own tomato from your own backyard instead of buying it. Most houses in the urban area are in the backyard. They could grow like tomatoes. They're encouraged to grow little things that could grow in your backyard that you could, you know, plants. It's something like water leaf. We grow it in your own backyard. That makes people feel good. So
Peter, I gotta leave it there, but great. Thank you. Please call us again. And Sultan in Manhattan, originally from Afghanistan, is that right?
That is correct. Thank you, Brian, for taking my call. I just returned back yesterday, in fact, from Afghanistan, and
I noted that many of your speakers kept using the example of China and India. And, of course, in between those billions of people, there's probably fairly large numbers of other populations and countries who really don't have the institutions, the perception, and the communication to even have a level of awareness to even talk about the subject. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what we assume to be a crisis, and perhaps it is a crisis, but it's also equally important to realize that there isn't a strategy or an idea on how do we bring to the attention of millions of people who are either uneducated, illiterate, and also living in dire poverty. You cannot take all these variables out, and while I agree that perhaps, as the caller was saying earlier today, that the solution is not just about, you know, talking about global warming, but we need to come up with alternative approaches. But it's also equally important to look at those that we miss in our calculation and our assumptions about what to do.
And yet I'm surprised at the bulk of the callers that we've taken so far not doing what the president of the Maldives did in the clip that we set this up with, which is saying, hey, you people in the mega-consuming developed world, my little country is going to drown here unless you curb it. People are calling up from Brazil and Nigeria and India and saying, no, the people in my country, even though we're not the big polluting countries, we're not taking it seriously enough in our own behavior. And that was not the dominant thread I expected to hear.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. And it is true that, you know, while in the world that we come from, we sure like to sort of ape the living standards and look at how consumerism works in the U.S. But for somebody who's lived in America for the last 47 years and having returned back to Afghanistan, I'm doing some work over there, it's amazing to me what distances they are between our perceptions of the problem here, as it seems to impact us in terms of global warming. You mentioned Sandy, and I was around here during Sandy. So yes, it's real, but how do we close this communication and perceptual gap? And I think that is really a challenge, much bigger than I think we tend to assume in many of our discussions.
Sultan, thank you very much for that, and thanks to all of you who called on this call-in for Immigrants from Anywhere section of our Earth Day family meeting on global warming. Up next, how oysters can help clean New York Harbor. Stay with us. And then let's bring Karen Armstrong into this conversation, the renowned religious scholar, author of many books, including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. She is also a former nun who is now a Muslim and creator of a
Muslim.
Are you not?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had read that. Forgive me, Karen. Forgive me. And creator of a document and a movement she calls the Charter for Compassion. You are that, right?
Yes, indeed.
And it's always enlightening to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
And we've just been taking calls, maybe you've heard the last few, on how people picture God and what happens when they pray. When you think of God, do you have an image of any kind in your head?
No, I don't. I take quite care not to have an image of God in my mind, because I think God goes beyond any kind of imagery or any kind of thought that we have or any kind of words that we use, really. And there's always it's always important to keep that sense of distinction between what I think about of God and the indescribable reality itself, because otherwise it's quite easy to make up a God in your own image and likeness.
So if God is that beyond anything, what does God mean to you? Is God the judge and the boss? Is God just love? Is God morally neutral? What is this God you keep putting in the title of your books?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that God, as we understand it, and this has been in all three of the monotheistic religions which center on the idea of God, there's always been this very strong tradition reminding us that what we think about God has no bearing on the absolute reality itself. Most theology has been about this until the modern period, when we started being a bit more confident that we could say exactly what God is. And that's made God incredible. God is transcendence. There is in human life always. There's always been this sense that there's something that always eludes us about the world. A sense of wonder and awe and majesty that we see it in the world about us and in other people too. It's important not to tie God down too much to a particular image. I don't pray myself. I've never been any good at it, even in my days as a nun. And I find my prayer, as it were, my main spiritual discipline is my study. I'm sitting right here at my desk right now, and I've put my books aside to talk to you. But sometimes when I'm absolutely involved in studying a sacred text very, very hard, I'll get moments of awe and wonder and delight, just mini seconds of that. Now, my Jewish colleagues tell me that's a very Jewish way of praying.
I was just going to say, that sounds like a very Jewish thing, getting it from the book, the Word.
Indeed. But also it's quite Christian. I think your last caller was talking about the religious life in the Catholic Church. Well, Benedictine monks used to spend some part of the day in what they call a divine study, where they immerse themselves in a text and get what they call mini seconds of oratio or prayer, when your mind is suddenly lifted in wonder.
In your book, A History of God, you describe why different cultures experienced, or dare I say, created God or a sense of the divine in the way they did at different times and places. Do you think, for the most part, that God is culturally constructed?
Well, that's a very modern question, because before the modern period in the West, religion wasn't a separate activity. As we think of it now as something that's very spiritual, all about God and praying and your inner world, that has really, that is cut off or separate from other activities of life. But in every culture in the pre-modern world, and that includes the Christian Europe, religion permeated all activities. All activities, indeed. So that politics, for example, was always seen as a sort of sacred activity. And all state ideologies were religious until the modern period. And so no other culture has this idea of religion as something sealed off mm-hmm. and separated. So trying to take religion out of culture, as it were, is a bit like trying to take the gin out of a cocktail.
So how do you see that, for example, if I may take a maybe controversial example, in the rise of conservative religion today, the Christian right in the U.S., the ultra-Orthodox among the Jews, and the radical Islamists? Do you see any common roots in today's global realities causing those?
Yes, I do. And part of this has been these radical movements you point out, as I explained in my book about the battle for God, have all arisen from a bruising conflict with secularism. All of them have been in some way damaged, if you like, or they feel attacked by a secularism that has been experienced or perceived as intrusive, invasive, and sometimes violent. In the Middle East, for example, secularist regimes such as those of Ataturk or the Shahs of Iran were extremely aggressive. On one occasion in 1935, for example, Shah Reza Pahlavi gave his soldiers orders to shoot at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western clothes. And hundreds of Iranians were killed that day. Now, in a context like this, where people have seen their clergy deprived of all their revenues or shot down and tortured or assassinated, secularism doesn't seem benign. And so in many parts of the world, where a secular society on the Western model has established itself, a religious countercultural movement has grown up alongside it, feeling bruised and wounded and determined to push God and religion back to center stage. And history shows that whenever these movements are attacked, they almost invariably become more extreme, because that confirms them in their suspicion that religion really is out to destroy them, to destroy their faith. Even in the United States, for example, many Christians in small-town America felt, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, a very sort of violent time with its world wars, that they were being colonized by the secular ethos of Harvard or Yale or Washington, and developed this sort of more, as we say, as they said, fundamentalist forms of Christianity.
Karen Armstrong, scholar of religion, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And listeners, how do you think your concept of God reflects the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today? Or how does your experience or practice of religion or perception reflect the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today? If you are a religious person, 212-433-WNYC, or spiritual, however you define it. And let's share some stories, thoughts, and feelings in relation to what Karen Armstrong is saying. I for this section of our family meeting on the Brian Lehrer Show on Passover and Easter, roughly defined, I would like to especially invite immigrants to call in, immigrants from anywhere. How do you see your religion as a reflection of the condition of your life or the culture we live in? And how do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? That's the essential question. Immigrants from everywhere and immigrants from anywhere on this section of the show. The call-in is for you right now. How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did God get pictured differently in your country of origin? Did people pray differently in your country of origin? And here, do these differences in prayer and how people experience God or picture God reflect the different lives that people lead there and here? Will any immigrants do a little history of God crowdsourcing for us on this? How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So Karen Armstrong, while those calls are coming in, you talked about getting your sense of spiritual joy, if that's the right term, from your study. Is there an emotion that you most feel in connection with your spiritual life? Could you identify one?
Yes. There is, as you say, this sense of wonder and awe and delight. But also, I have to say, a sense of profound disquiet. Because most of the world religions begin with a perception that there's something very wrong with the world, that people are hungry, that people are suffering, that there's injustice in the world, there's an imbalance of power and wealth, people are lonely, sick, dying. The first noble truth of Buddhism is a religion, life is dukkha, it's suffering, awry, there's always something wrong. And in the Christian world, in the Western Christian world, you have an image of a man in an extremity of agony, an agony inflicted upon him by other human beings. And so I think this sense of disquiet, a sense that there's something wrong. The Prophet Muhammad said, not one of you can be a believer if he can sleep when he knows that somebody is hungry. Mm. And now we have this global vision of the world, and we see the suffering that's going on not only in our own society, but also worldwide. That was the impulse really behind my Charter for Compassion, that religions should rally to this call to try to assuage the suffering that we see around us. And in that sort of reaching out to others, and we can't confine it, we're not allowed to confine it to our own group of people or our own cronies. We have to have, as one Chinese sage put it, Yan Ai, concern for everybody. Love the stranger, says Leviticus. Love your enemies, says Jesus. Reach out to all tribes and nations, says the Quran. And from that sense of outreach, there can come a sense of joy and a sense of freedom, really, as you leave your selfish, self-preoccupied state behind.
Joy and freedom from moral outrage and moral sleeplessness, according to Karen Armstrong, with who we will continue in a minute, in addition to your calls on this Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God. Stay with us. It's a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God this morning. Our current guest, the religious scholar Karen Armstrong, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And let's take some calls from some of the immigrants among you to talk about whether you think God has a different meaning, religion has a different meaning, whether people pray differently or picture God differently in the country that you came from or the culture that you came from or the conditions that you came from compared to here. Let's try Gloria in Westchester to start this off. Hi, Gloria. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Adore your show.
Thank you.
Yes, I was raised in a country that was 95% Catholic. I am now a recovering Catholic. When the church told me that I couldn't use birth control, and when I stopped using birth control to go back for the absolution, so I never went back.
What country are you from originally?
Colombia.
And do you think that people in Colombia experience their Catholicism differently from the people you know here, even though you personally are lapsed?
Colombia is still very much a Catholic country, but as I came to the United States and began to study and read things that were not allowed for me to read in Colombia, even at the university, I realized that all the sacred texts were man-written, and therefore God became a man, and all they do is impose more rules and hardship.
And the same here as there, basically.
Yes.
Because my question is to ask you to compare the experience of Catholicism that you think people have in Colombia or people you knew in Colombia compared to what you see in the United States. Anything on that?
Well, the United States is much more ecumenical because the separation of church and state. Colombia didn't have a separation of church and state until 1992. So everybody was Catholic, and the bishops ran the country as they wanted to. And so definitely it's a very different way of seeing the Catholic Church here or in Colombia.
Gloria, thank you so much.
Let's
try Yaya in the Bronx. Do I have your name right? Is it Yaya?
Yes, sir. You have my name right.
Thank you for calling. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Yemen in the Middle East.
So what would you like to compare?
I would like to compare the way my interaction with the society feels in Yemen and in the United States. So in Yemen, it's very much the same religion as Islam, and you don't experience any kind of diversity in religions. But when I came to the United States, there's different religions, there's different sects of religions. There's different churches, there's different mosques, Sunni and Shiite, and there's, you know, diversity. And the beautiful thing about this country is that de facto the government is supporting diversity, and no one can impose anything upon you.
Did it give you a different relationship with your, I'm assuming you're Muslim, once you came here that you still identify, but your relationship to it changed?
Actually, my experience with Islam has increased when I came to the United States. The Muslim population in the United States is actually more religious than the populations in the Middle East. In the mosque, people are more dedicated to the mosque. People come and spare donations. People come, and Ramadan feels different in the United States than it feels in the Middle East.
Really? More devoted? Do you think that's a matter of the choice that people have here as opposed to the obligation and only one way to do things that you were describing home in Yemen?
Yeah, I think people in the United States, because they miss where they're from and they live in a different society, they want to feel more connected with where they're from and their faith. And I find it surprising at first when I saw that people in here, my colleagues and my friends, are actually more practicing Muslims than the ones in Yemen. Like, we actually have, like, Friday seminars and Saturday seminars that I've benefited from more than I have learned in Yemen. So.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Karen Armstrong, that's an intriguing call, a counterintuitive call maybe, that Muslims here would be more observant than the ones in Yemen where he came from. And I think it relates to what you were describing earlier about how until the modern era, when we would look at things from the outside and ask ourselves if religion is culturally constructed, that it's so interwoven with the society, the more traditional society that he came from, that it takes on a different meaning. What were you thinking as you heard that call?
Well, it is quite common for immigrants to be more observant in their new country than they were at home. And also it gives people a sense of community, of familiarity, too, a sort of link with home, if you like. It's certainly also, I think, the case here in the UK. In the UK, we are a very secular country indeed. Only 6% of the population attend a religious service regularly here.
So much more secular than the United States.
Far, far more secular. It's always intriguing to me that when I come to the United States, I can talk to people very differently about religion than from here. I mean, I have friends who are sort of rather appalled that I managed to make a living out of writing about this discredited stuff about religion. But I think that a large proportion of that 6% of people who are observant in this country are Muslim. I think they've bumped up our national average considerably. So I think it's not called counterintuitive. It's quite a common phenomenon.
Nicholas in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello, Brian. Thank you. I'm actually originally from Palestine, but I'm raised Greek Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in this country quite a few years. You can feel the division where I was raised as a Greek Orthodox, and then I became a Baptist since I went to the school there, between the religions, between a Muslim, Christian, and a Jewish, because it was under the Israeli government as well. Whereas when you come to this country, and you don't feel that division between religions as much as you would feel when you are back home. And it's quite, unfortunately, it's not right for the people to be feeling this way, because they all, as people, should be more equal. But the mentality and the way they are raised, and then the Baptist community that I belong to, later on when I came to America, I found out that it's more about money and really for the priest or the pastor that does preaching, that he actually collects the money to have a better financial situation for him and maybe have a Learjet that he spreads the word of God, whereas the rest of the people here really are not in that situation, but they give the money to them because they are followers.
So does this make you cynical about religion here, about even your religion here?
It does, because really I believe in myself. I believe that there is a God. You know, I don't know what form. It's a force that exists. I don't think it's a human, because it's a force. But I disregard the sections of religion, because it creates problems among people. And it creates problems as well in the world. And here we have, unfortunately, the racism problem, but Religion is the base of the problems that we have in this world.
Nicholas, thank you very much. Marie in Queens, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Miss Armstrong. Just to answer your question just briefly, I'm from the Caribbean, I'm from Haiti, and how we worship there differently, I want to say it's about the wealth of the country and our resources are limited. We're open to God in everything that we do. We bare our souls when we worship, so it's not superficial. Even in this country where you go to Haitian congregations, they pray much differently than we do, as English speakers. We
like
bare
how?
Our souls. We give everything.
Is it more ecstatic? Is it more loud?
No. I'm from a very conservative congregation. We're Seventh-day Adventist Sabbatarians.
Uh-huh.
We're less proud of, physical accomplishment and worldly things. We really focus on God and our relationship with Him. All the external and superficial college degrees, money, that is all set aside when we worship where I'm from. I don't know if it has to do with the situation of the country. Here in this country, I find that we're a little proud when we approach God.
Proud?
Yeah.
Too proud of us as individuals and
Correct.
Our egos?
Yes, too proud. Like, for example, I'm Brian Lehrer. I have a great show. You know, when I approach God, I'm not as a sinner. I don't approach Him as a sinner and that He creates me. He gives me this job. He gave me health this morning. So where I'm from, we go to the minute. We go to the very small detail of who God is to us as our creator, as the giver of life, pardoning our sins.
Yes.
You know, He will resurrect us again. We go to the detail, and it's an everyday thing. I find with English speakers in this country, we're a little, proud. I think that's the best word I can say.
Yeah, Marie, thank you so much. So well put. Karen Armstrong, maybe a great example of religion being culturally constructed or the individual's relationship to it.
Yes, I think there's certainly a lot to be said for our very capitalist-driven societies where where the whole emphasis is often on efficiency, progress, wealth. And also, we are very sort of puffed up about ourselves in the Western world, I think, generally. And it's ego. It's ego, selfishness, greed that your previous caller was saying about people just embezzling or sort of taking money from the congregations. It's that holds us back from the divine and from our best selves and from enlightenment. And the whole point about religion is to lose the self, to put the self to one side. And the best way of doing that is by concentrating on the other in compassion
and
putting another person in the center of your world.
And in the context of our culture, so much of that, I think, would be about losing the privilege. I was in D.C. over the weekend, and I saw the Martin Luther King Memorial for the first time. And one of the things that struck me about the quotes that were engraved there was his universalism. He was a Christian preacher, but he would say things about how we need to go beyond our own race, religion, tribe, and our connection to the world. I think the Easter and Passover stories can both connect us to the world or just connect us to our religious or cultural tribes. But what King was talking about from an American perspective, especially in the late 60s, the latter part of his life, when he got into anti-Vietnam War protesting, was, I think, to see the rest of the world through our lens of privilege as Americans, even Black Americans.
Yes, and it's a coincidence, Brian, because 2 weeks ago I was in Atlanta at Morehouse College, which is Martin Luther King's college.
Yes.
And we were I was there for the anniversary of his death. And you're quite right about King. And I think that his experience, you see, of suffering, of marginalization, gave him, instead of using that experience of pain to inflict pain on other people, it gave him an insight into the pain and marginalization of people all over the world. And I think that is a huge example of what religion can do. It's to open our hearts to the suffering of others and work hard, as he did, for a better world, with that sense of disquiet that I was talking about earlier. And of course, it reminds us that religion isn't all about having a nice, warm experience. It can be dangerous and risky. I mean, he, like Gandhi, lost his life. Was killed, and there's that religion is something that puts us on the edge, not to make us too comfortable in this world.
So in our last minute, do you see these holidays of Easter and Passover as making your compact for compassion either easier or harder to achieve?
Compassion is always something that's hard to achieve. But it's also something that human beings recognize in the core of their being as something that is not just a nice idea, but absolutely essential, I think, for the survival of our species, that we learn to treat all others, whoever they are, as we wish to be treated ourselves. If we don't do this, we're not going to have a viable world. Now, interestingly, some of the people who've come forward to help me most with the charter have not been religious people, but secular people. But I think we can all see at the heart of these religious celebrations the ideals of the religious life, the ideal of freedom, of liberation, of turning our backs, as it were, upon oppression, which is the story of the Passover. And Abelard, the great French philosopher, said that when we look at the agony of Jesus on the cross, our hearts break within us, and it is that act of compassion that saves us rather than just his sacrificial death.
Karen Armstrong, author of best-selling books on religion and founder of the Charter for Compassion, which you can see at charterforcompassion.org. Thank you so much. Happy Easter, happy Passover, happy life.
Happy Easter, happy Passover, and all the good wishes to you too, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.